The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is a great way to stay on top of the latest from China in just a few minutes a day with a free email newsletter, artisanally curated and handcrafted by the one and only Jeremy Goldcorn. I can say artisanal and handcrafted because he now sports an increasingly hipsterish beard. You do. Or you can check out. Yeah. Or,
no, this is a hobo beard. I'm sorry. I haven't tailored it all.
Yes, okay. Anyway, SubChina, blah, blah, blah. Feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. And doing so maybe not so very artisanally, huh? I am Kaiser Guo. I am in Midtown East in Manhattan today, stopping through New York on my way to Beijing and to Dalian. Joining me here is SubChina Editor-in-Chief Jeremy Goldcorn, who you already know is, I have to tell you, I mean, he wanted to do this show in Williamsburg so he'd go get his hipster mustache waxed after the show. Anyway, great to see you, Jeremy.
Thank you. I don't know if it's so great to see you, but I'm looking forward to this show.
I no longer have facial hair. Yeah. I've shorn mine off. Anyway, at the start of the show, I want to state very plainly and for the record that I am in no way related, that I'm aware of, to Guo Wengui, the subject of today's podcast, in spite of my surname being Guo also. Guo Wengui is, of course, the billionaire now on the lam, living a mere 13 blocks from here, if I'm counting right, over in the Sherry Netherland on Fifth Avenue overlooking Central Park. The man is a real piece of work. His whole meteoric rise, at least as recounted by our friends over at Caixin, is proof that in the China of the reform era, even someone from a very modest background and educational attainment can amass tremendous wealth so long as they are not encumbered by morals. His dirt-dishing tweet storms, his total decentering of the truth, and his bold or maybe shameless publicity stunts have made it hard not to pay attention, sort of how it is with another certain property developer who also sits at the intersection of money and political power and is also often found at Mar-a-Lago.
So whenever you find yourself at the intersection of Chinese money and Chinese political power, one person you're very likely to see standing there with a reporter's notebook in hand is Mike Forsyth. Mike is a reporter for the New York Times, which he joined after exposing Bloomberg's big China compromise when Bloomberg tried to kill a story he had been working on relating to money and power in the very highest echelons of Chinese politics. Mike now lives here in New York, and he recently co-authored a fascinating story about Guo Wengui. Welcome to Seneca, Mike.
Good to be here.
And Mike, yeah, great to have you here finally. It's been way too long. We haven't had you on the show. I can't believe it. Mike's co-author on that piece is also our guest today on Seneca, Alexandra Stevenson. Alex writes on money and banking for the New York Times. She wrote previously for the Financial Times and has studied Chinese in the city of Dalian. She's headed back to Asia pretty soon to take up a post for the New York Times in Hong Kong. Alex, welcome to Seneca.
Nice to be here.
So let's start out with some basic background for our listeners, because if you haven't been following the story of Guo Wengui, it's very long and confusing. Would it be possible for either of you to give us the potted biography, the one-minute version of Guo Wengui? Who is he and what is he doing now that is putting him in the news?
No, that would not be possible. It's impossible because his life is so complicated and there's so many competing versions of it. We don't even know when he was born. He says one thing, his ID card says another thing. He says he was born in 1970, which almost is hard to believe because that puts some of the most, you know, formative parts of his life. He was doing things when he was, you know, getting married when he was 14 or 15, taking part in Tiananmen when he was 19, which isn't unusual, but it was what he was doing, which was passing out money, he says, to Tiananmen demonstrators at that age of 19, which is unusual.
Maybe he married at 14 into money.
Maybe he did. You know, we haven't seen his wife. His wife is apparently here. That also adds to the mystery too. You know, there's a lot of illusion about this guy. But anyway, he was jailed in 1989. He says it's because of his support for the students. There's some records that have been broadcast in the overseas media that suggest it was for fraud. He was doing an oil scam where he was selling the same amount of oil many, many times over and over again. So it's there's so much about his life that is you know, a mystery. But we do know that he rose from, yes, indeed, some sort of obscurity. Hometown is in western Shandong province, so eastern China, kind of near the border with Henan. He grew up, though, in northeastern China, in Jilin, hence his kind of northern accent that he has, rather than not an unintelligible Henan western Shandong accent.
You're talking to a son of western Shandong in Henan.
Yeah, well, we all know how hard it is to understand.
How inarticulate they are.
Yeah. But as a young man, he was jailed. After he was out of jail, which was in Henan, he did run into some, you know, made some contacts with some business people, he says, and that got him into the property business. And by the tender age, by his count of 21 or 22, he was already developing a massive luxury hotel in Zhengzhou, the capital of Henan.
None of this seems remotely plausible to me. What about the story that he has about him and his brother having attacked a cop or something like that, and then his brother having been killed? Is that part of his myth, of his legend as well? Alex, do you know anything
about
this?
Yeah, I mean, that's... So everything about Guo Menghui requires a certain amount of suspension of disbelief, and he only talks about the things that suit his sort of origin story and where he's going. And so the story about being in jail is sort of in his telling that is the foundational to why he's doing what he's doing today, which is to kind of bring transparency and democracy in of some form to China. And so for him, it was formative because it taught him to kind of, you know, brace himself against authority. But I was just going to say, I mean, because we started out with what his background is, right. but we should also say today he's in New York City on the 18th floor of a luxurious, the Sherry Netherland Hotel. He has this great setup, and he has these sweeping views of Central Park.
Oh, you guys have been
Park.
Up there, huh?
Yeah.
For a long time.
Oh, wow.
Twice. And from his apartment, he's firing off these tweets and he's live streaming these sessions on YouTube where he's basically, you know, leveling serious accusations against Wang Qishan and other senior officials and also corporate officials. So there's sort of this trajectory from, I guess you could start, he likes to start with the jail to today, to what he's doing today, but.
And we skipped the middle. So yeah. we were last with him in Zhengzhou, Henan. He's made $1 million off real estate, luxury hotel. And then how does he get to Beijing? How does he get the Panggu building, the ugliest building in Beijing next to the Olympic field? How does he get in trouble and end up in New York?
Right. So he did start making real political connections when he was in Henan. That's pretty clear. He says himself that he got a chance to meet Li Keqiang, the current prime minister or premier, who when he was a party secretary down there in Henan. He also befriended Wu Yi, who was
the Iron Lady.
The Iron Lady. There was somebody in Washington that said she was stronger than a garlic milkshake. Anyway, apparently, you know, he had, you know, made sure that her favorite chef was at this hotel, the Yueda Hotel in Henan when she was visiting, and that greatly pleased her. So there was a relationship that was started there, you know, a political relationship. He then, from what we understand, he did get to start meeting some people in the security, you know, apparatus, Wu Guangzheng, and then Ma Jian then came on after him. And he moved from Henan to Beijing. And from there, started developing his properties. Getting the Panggu was pretty bare knuckles because
is right. I mean, the way at least that it was told by Cai Xin, which we should disclose as our partner in one venture there, but Cai Xin did a big story on him. It was sort of the first big one to break, at least in more or less mainstream media about him in 2015. And it really recounts a lot of, you know, backstabbing and betrayal and just bold-faced blackmail, right? How much of this have you been able to corroborate?
So certainly when you talk to Guo himself and what he's been saying in his lengthy interviews that he's had just in the last few months, he actually corroborates a lot of it. The fact that, you know, he makes no bones about it, that his political patron that is Ma Jian, who is the vice minister of state security, or was. He's in jail now. And he makes it very clear also that he did procure this sex tape for this vice mayor of Beijing, who is standing in his way from securing this amazing property, vast tract of land, you know, next to the Beijing Olympic.
A Monty Python reference.
Yeah. That was the first of many, if you don't mind. And so he, you know, those things are pretty straightforward, part of the record. And so Tsai Xin was the first really to really nail that down.
And, I mean, his troubles with official China seem to more or less coincide with the Tsai Xin article in 2015. Is that correct?
Ma Jian's fall, right?
Yeah. I think this is where the limitations of Tsai Xin come in.
Okay.
Tsai Xin is great, but they can only go so far. So why did he all of a sudden run into trouble? And the way Guo explains it, and he said this in his March 8th interview with Mirror Ming Jing here in New York, he explained that the reason he did is he like Icarus, he got a little too close to the sun. And the sun in this case was the actual son of He Guoqiang, the predecessor to Wang Qishan, as head of Discipline Inspection Commission. And he was saying, Guo was saying that it was the son of He Guoqiang who was actually the big owner in Founder Securities, which he was trying to take over and muscle into. None of that was in the Tsai Xin article. It actually is true. And we had a document. We had looked after the Tsai Xin article.
He Guoqiang's son was the major stakeholder.
The family certainly had a stake in Founder Securities, indirect. And actually Guo kind of spelled that out. We actually had all the records on that at the time, because after the Tsai Xin article, we actually started looking, you know, into this, and, we never published anything, but we had it all, right? And so when he brought it up again this year, just kind of looked at our notes and were like, well, gosh, he's actually right. And I think it's not a huge leap of logic to think that, you know, when you're going up against, you know, a senior retired cadre like that, a very, very senior guy, that could very well have been Guo's downfall.
So far, obscure origins, but otherwise, I don't hear a whole ton of untruths. Is it all wheat here, or is there chaff that we have to deal with as well?
I think there's a lot of untruths. Let me count the ways.
Okay, let's do it.
No, I mean, I think he's very quick to kind of spin tales that later don't look to be that true. And I wish I could get into real specifics, but in one instance, we asked about a person that's associated with the big HNA family, the Wang Qishan family, and he spun us one tale. And that tale does not look to be true at all. In another instance, he was on a podcast and was explaining in no uncertain terms that Hu Shuli, the editor of Tsai Xin, had given me back in 2012 all the documents for the Xi Jinping.
Given me, Mike Forsyth,
all the documents for the Xi Jinping expose we did at Bloomberg, which I knew and Hu Shuli knew was not true because I wrote this, you know, doing the story. So
he said a lot of nasty things about Hu Shuli.
Hmm. Yes.
Yeah, they have a huge feud going on.
And here's another thing, you know, just kind of the general, I've always been struck by how so many people in the overseas Chinese media, so many people really get quite enamored of him. He's kind of like the Pied Piper, right? But again, he did send a sex tape out with the Beijing vice mayor in order to get some property. But he also published the ID number and the full name of a minor, a 12, 13-year-old boy, who he claimed was the love child of Hu Shuli and his former business partner, who was Founder Group. This is some pretty bare-knuckle, tough stuff. And those things are always floating in my head when I hear these, you know, overseas Chinese people waxing poetic about how this guy is going to change China and bring democracy to China.
What does it say that anyone gives him any credibility at all here in the overseas Chinese community?
Oh, come on. I find that completely understandable. He's one of the few people who knows things who's bad-mouthing the Communist Party. That's very attractive to a lot of people.
What I'm trying to get at is, I mean, is it just decade on decade of opacity and lies that have just sort of inured people to this? I mean, who are ready to believe anything now? You think that's sort of what's going on here?
I think he says what they want to hear.
What about what he's saying about Wang Tishan's family? Because he's made, I mean, basically, as far as I understand it, he says that Wang Tishan's wife, Yao Mingshan, is a U.S. citizen. He posted what he says is her social security number to the internet. And what he says is the address of the house she owns in a very lovely town that I've actually stayed in called Saratoga in Northern California. Is this just complete nonsense, or, you know, what's your take on it?
Have you run that down?
It's old wine in a new bottle. You know, I mean, I think the overseas Chinese media, we've known about this house since 2012. And if you look at the property records, it certainly indicates that at one point or another, Yao Mingshan was at the house, which is owned by, it looks to be owned by her sister and her sister's husband. It's a nice place, worth more than $5 million in Saratoga. But of course, every house in Saratoga is worth more than $1 million. And she does look to have a social security number. But again, that's not, you know, a lot of Chinese people in the United States have social security numbers. The passport, we have absolutely no evidence. And the people I've talked to, you know, recently, very recently, they all said it would be very surprising if Wang Qishan allowed or had knowledge of his wife getting a U.S. passport at a time when his career was taking off. It just didn't make a lot of sense. So we have absolutely no evidence that Yao Mingshan is a U.S. citizen. It's not a crime for her at all to have a U.S. Social Security number either.
Well, you get one with a green card, right?
Yeah, you know.
You don't even need a green card to get a Social Security number.
And it's really easy to get one. It does look like the property records that are, which in America are pretty good, do suggest that she did spend some time in the United States in the 90s and into the last decade, though.
But there's nothing like a smoking gun, evidence of massive corruption. We know that the wife of a well-connected senior politician spent some time in America, which is not really that surprising.
They're dots that still need to be connected. But to go back to your question about why do people want to believe it, I guess one way to answer that here would be, you know, he's basically claiming that H&A, this huge conglomerate that has been scooping up left, right, and center, American assets, European assets, banks, hedge funds, you name it. He's basically claiming that Wang Qishan's family owns, or Wang Qishan through family members, owns a significant stake in the company. And I think for Americans, at least, because it's become a headline, H&A has become a headline company that came out of the blue suddenly last year, and then really was in the sort of spotlight right during the inauguration, because one of Trump's advisors owned a hedge fund that, and he was trying to get rid of it, well, sell it so that he could join the administration. And suddenly H&A popped out of the wings, like just perfect timing. And so I think a lot of people started raising questions. And in Washington, there were questions raised about what was this company and why was it trying to seek influence? And a lot of things get mixed up, but people become interested when you put China and mysterious but acquisitive company.
Sure.
And so I think, and then suddenly he's like firing these allegations about Wang Qishan, who is China's anti-corruption czar. And so, you know, I think that's like a perfect storm for this kind of like intrigue. That's
Alex, explain the timing of the allegations. Why did he start when he started? I mean, he had this material for a long time. He'd been in the States for months.
Yeah, that's a good question. We asked him that because, you know, this is, according to Guo, he's been preparing for this moment for 28 years. So when we asked him why, what was his answer? It was kind of...
He talked a little bit about like Abu Dhabi and Meng Jianzhu, you know, the security minister, you know, so...
But none of it really made sense.
And he also talked about his like fortune teller, I think, said it was like, it was a very auspicious year to tweet, or you know, it was a special year to bring up big things.
But there's also the timing of Xiao Jianhua.
So yeah, I mean, when we asked him this, one of the things, you know, that may have prompted him, because he had come to the United States in late 2014 and he had been totally quiet. We hadn't heard anything from him. And then all of a sudden, I think it was on January 26th, he did this interview with Mirror Media, which is based here in Long Island, in Chinese, which, you know, he just came, just exploded out on the scene. And then
correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't there some suspicion that he was in fact detained in China? people didn't know where he was?
There were always so, you know, there's so much, you know, we had heard that he was in the United States, and I didn't know if he had been, you know, any of the stories that he had been taken back, you know, to China or anything. But, so why did he all of a sudden, you know, become vocal? And one thing he did say is that there was more and more pressure on him that, Meng Jianzhu, who is the, you know, the
head of PSB chief,
yeah, right? the law and politics guy in the Politburo, had actually gone to Abu Dhabi and, you know, was pressuring the government there to put pressure on Guo or get Guo back to China. He is a citizen of Abu Dhabi. In fact, he looks pretty good in an Arab headdress in a beard. He looks almost passable. And
it's one of the 13 passports he says he has.
Yes, yes. He has lots of passports.
Wow.
You know, an international man of mystery. So that's one of the reasons. The timing with Xiao Jianhua was fascinating, though, because it was really only a few hours later, and I was there in Hong Kong at the time, that Xiao was looked like he was abducted. He was taken from the Four Seasons and smuggled across you know, the border into mainland China.
From Hong Kong
into,
right.
Another billionaire Chinese tycoon.
That's
for
right.
Our listeners who may not have been following.
That's right, yes. And so it is interesting, the timing. And also, I mean, obviously, you know, it's the run-up to the big 19th Party Congress of the Communist Party later this year, and it is the silly season for politics, you know, in China now. Things happen in these years.
Can we talk a little bit about two figures, powerful or once powerful figures, who are often mentioned as being closely connected with Guo? And of course, I'm speaking about Ma Jian, who was the Vice Minister for State Security, and also Zhang Yue, who was a Hebei provincial
secretary.
Can you tell us a bit more about them and Guo's ties to them?
And, you know, how he made use of them, or right. Seems to have made use of them.
So, yeah, I haven't really looked much at Zhang Yue, and he doesn't talk about Zhang Yue. He talks about Ma all the time, and he always speaks about Ma in terms of reverence and respect, which is pretty rare for him, because I think most of the politicians in China, he does have a considerable amount of disdain for. But Ma, he always treats with respect. And I don't know. I mean, Alex and I were talking to one person, you know, who's kind of describing that relationship in great detail, too.
Yeah, he was saying that, what, like 5, 6 or more years ago, when he saw him in Beijing, he was constantly taking phone calls from Ma Jian. Or at least that's what he would say.
Right.
So
right.
That was, yeah. I mean, that was a long time ago, but...
And Ma himself, he had a confession that was a video release, and Ma in the confession, and obviously this was a Chinese confession, it did look like he was reading it, so you know, you do have to take it with a big grain of salt. But he, you know, Ma recounted many instances where you know, he would get financial benefits from Guo, and then Ma would intervene in the bureaucracy for one land deal or another deal, you know, on Guo's
behalf. Just basically wholesale appropriating land and giving it to, handing it over to Guo or something,
yeah,
like that, or
yeah,
clearing the way for him in some way or another.
Yeah.
There's another guy, Meng Huiqing, who was actually a CCDI official, right? So he's from the Central Committee for Discipline Inspection official, who was brought down, I think it was 2 years ago. But the verdict was just released recently, I think probably opportunistically by the Beijing Second Intermediate Court. And, these records sort of seem to show the modus operandi of our friend Guo. I guess I'm, you know, it's pretty clear that this guy, I mean, to anyone who looks closely at this, that this guy is every bit as corrupt and every bit as sinister as some of the people he's now pointing his fingers at. I guess I'm trying to get my head around why he has so much popular support. He seems every bit as unsavory as the worst allegations he's making about the political figures he wants to take down.
I think that's too simple.
Yeah.
I mean, don't you? I mean, because he's kind of a charming guy,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah,
well,
and he comes across as a hero figure, right? I mean, people don't have to have long, most people have short memories. And I think he's emerged as, you know, at a time when there is a lot of political intrigue in an important year for China. And I think he just, you know, people, maybe it's just like popular entertainment.
He is very charismatic. I mean,
yeah,
he reminds me in many ways of Donald Trump, but he has a different kind of charisma. I mean, I found myself now watching or even just listening to his Meng Jing interviews just because I like the sound of his voice.
Really? You don't find him to be extremely tu?
Well,
Well, I mean, he's of a certain kind. He reminds me of the online celebrity, you know, Papi Zhang has this great imitation of a Chinese film director, or, you know, a rich guy wants to make movies,
right,
telling her, you know, the scriptwriter. Yeah, it's very funny. He kind of reminds me of that kind of personality, outsized rich Chinese businessman.
I mean, we've talked about this. He's a P.T. Barnum, and you sort of feel like you're in a show with him when you're sitting down talking to him, like that you're part of this bigger kind of theatrical event. Do you feel that way?
I totally do. And I mean, maybe we shouldn't talk about this here, but you know, this is the decade of self-confessions and putting everything on Facebook. That's all your personal life. So why not? I mean, he really wants reporters to be in on this with him. You know, this is this big mission to, you know, first the mission was to get rid of Wang Qishan and Meng Jianzhu,
right,
and Fu Zhenghua. So this is, Fu Zhenghua would be the vice minister of public security who, you know, he's clashed with, is kind of his real, you know, immediate, foe. And then Wang Qishan and Meng Jianzhu. And that was his, when we first met him in late April at his apartment, that was his goal to do that. But now, having had lunch with him this week, he's kind of upped the ante now. And I think now is it fair to say, Alex, that he really wants to overthrow, you know, the system. That's what he says, at least.
Yeah, he speaks in grander terms now. And maybe that's because it's fueled by the attention that he's getting. I mean, he did talk about, you know, X number of Twitter followers and, you know, Y number of viewers on my last YouTube live stream, you know.
So very Trumpish.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's what I'm thinking.
Possibly Donald Trump wasn't serious about being president either, right? And then he realized...
Trumpish, but he's actually much more charming. He's much more, it's a little less egocentric than Trump in the fact that he's trying to praise you all the time and lift you up, not lift you up, but at least say exaggeratingly nice things about you as well. It's a little different from Trump. Would I rather have a beer with him or Trump? I'd rather have a beer with him.
Oh yeah.
Trump
wouldn't have a beer anyway.
He doesn't drink. Yeah, Trump. Yeah. So.
But by our second meeting with him, he was talking about, like, you know, are you guys on the same page as me? Are we going to work towards greater China-U.S. cooperation? And it got a little weird because we were sort of like, well, we're just journalists. I mean, we're just here to, like, you know, hear what you have to say. We're not here to, like, commit to some grand commitment. And so, it seems as though, I guess he's been gradually working up to this point, but it's like he's playing the sort of diplomat as well in some strange kind of way.
What's your sense of how well he understands the way it works in the West, here in the United States? I mean, this kind of thing, the idea that he thinks he can enlist in his cause two independent New York Times journalists, that seems to me to be deeply deluded.
Well, the thing is, he didn't reach out to us initially.
Okay.
You reached out to him on Twitter.
Sure. But this idea that during your lunches with him that, you know, he thinks that he's, you know, you're going to be on the same page. You're going to work together for his grand vision. I mean, does this guy have any sense for how politics works in America?
Strangely, I think he has more of a sense than most people do.
Okay.
So first of all, you know, he has accomplished his goal of drawing a lot of attention to Wang Qishan. And so he has changed the agenda of some journalists, you know, who are now focused on looking at, you know, at this family and, you know, trying to figure out if what Wang Qishan or what Guo Wengui is saying is true or not. And so, you know, it's fascinating what he's saying. There's some nuggets that he says, some things he says are, they have the ring of truth.
What can you tell us about any connections with HNA?
I can't, you know, but it's just really interesting. And there's a lot of, there are some things.
Enough to keep you interested and keep
there's paying. There's enough there to keep us really interested. There's other things that he puts out that are clearly wrong or exaggerated, kind of like this thing with Yao Mingshan just isn't panning out. A couple of weeks ago, he put out one of his first files that he put out was, on this guy, Yao Qing. Who is supposed to be there is a Yao Qing who is a grandson of Yao Yilin, so nephew-in-law of Wang Qishan. But the Yao Qing file he put up was clearly not the right Yao Qing. It was a totally different guy. So some of the stuff he puts out is just not quite right. But other things he puts out, and I don't know how right he knows it is interesting. And so it's enough to keep us interested, definitely.
So he's succeeding.
In that way. Yeah.
What about is there any dirt sticking to Wang Qishan back in Beijing? And do you think that Guo is in fact going to make actually any serious problems for the Communist Party for the 19th Party Congress this fall.
I mean, they're dots. They haven't been connected yet. But they're dots that need to be connected.
I mean, are people in Beijing, people of consequence in Beijing, looking at these dots and thinking that they want to connect them?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not there anymore. Certainly I'm hearing that he's, you know, there's a lot more attention on him. But I'm hearing both versions. You know, one version is like the stuff he's saying isn't so consequential. You know, in order for Wang Qishan to get onto the Politburo, he had to give a full report about his family. This back in 2007. Some of this theoretically is already part of the record, the party record, and is not going to be shocking to other leaders if the fact that his wife was overseas, you know, or things like that. But on the other hand, it does seem like a lot of people are talking about it, you know, talking to my colleagues that are in China. I just, you know, making predictions about American politics is hard enough, and boy, a lot of us have gotten that wrong. Making predictions about Chinese politics, and God, it is Mug's so game. Difficult. But it is fascinating because it does look like Wang Qishan, you know, there was an assumption until only a few months ago, I think, that
he was going to be elevated.
He was going to be elevated. He was going to allow to be stayed on, you know,
past the unofficial retirement.
That's
age.
Right. Right. So they have the Qishang Ba Xia, and he was Ba and almost Jiu. Yeah. And, you know, he was going to go. He was going to be able to stay on. But I don't think you're hearing that as much anymore.
But also one of our colleagues said that the sort of entrepreneur and business community in China have expressed concern about the focus on Wang Qishan. And, you know, there's a little bit of confusion on Wall Street with some of the big firms that do business in China, because Wang Qishan has always been their guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like kind of the bridge to China. Hank Paulson calls him a buddy. Tim Geithner
Uncle.
He referred to Wang Qishan as uncle. And so it's interesting because there's been reverberations, and they're small right now, but both in China, from what we hear in the business community, but also a little bit on Wall Street, in terms of in the way of confusion. So
let's talk about how Beijing has tried to manage this crisis from the time that it broke out in January. What have they done, and how has their strategy apparently shifted?
That's also really confusing. And it does kind of lend credence to the fact that he may have some support there. Clearly, before his breakout interviews in January, it does look like there was an effort to get him back at some point. But in April, after he had already been talking for a few months, you know, it did look like they unleashed some of the domestic media to do investigative stories at him, or had pre-made investigative stories or stories come out about him. But that stopped all of a sudden in late April. Mm. You got nothing, except about 3 weeks later, you started getting some more stuff from Caixin, just that one news organization, which has a lot looser leash, you know, than most news organizations in China.
And also, they say some ties to Wang Qishan.
They do. And then he has said that his wife and his daughter, he has two children that we know of, a son who... In this is Miles Kwok is his Western name, and his son is Mileson. kind of like Offred, you know. Yeah. Mileson was already like outside of the mainland China, but his daughter, who went to NYU, actually with Ma Jian's daughter, he says, at the same time. She was in China. His wife was in China as well, and he says they were allowed to leave. We have not seen them, but we do have it on assurances that they are here. And that's kind of odd, I think, that they were allowed to leave China. And there was another incident that we wrote about, kind of, you know, the phone call, which was kind of interesting.
Let's in on this phone call. What's the phone call?
Well, it was a little weird. And I should just say, because it gets a little complicated talking about...
None of this has been complicated so far.
having met with him, because, you know, and you asked earlier about who's leading who in these interactions, and are we kind of being brought into his sort of part of his spin. And the thing is that we showed up and it wasn't supposed to be an interview, and it wasn't supposed to be on the record. And so, you know, Mike and I, throughout the first 6-hour interaction, were trying to figure out, like, and afterwards, how do we use some of this and how do we get it on the record? And that was a tortured process. But so I'm going to, I guess we can kind of recount
because we did a
how we wrote it in the, and so it was really bizarre because, you know, it's like 5 hours into this interaction with this guy who is larger than life, and it's dark out at this point. We showed up for tea and stayed till after dinner, and he's taken us outside to show us the sweeping view of Central Park. And his assistant comes out, and she whispers something into his ear, and then points to the phone, and he looks at us and he goes, "Oh, well, somebody important has called," and he mentions a name, which turns out not to be true. Which we didn't write about, but he's basically insinuating that, like, somebody, you know, at Zhongnan High is calling. And then he dials the number and he looks at us and he kind of says, "Well, this is so and so," and he puts it on speaker so we can hear the conversation and hear the other person on the other side of the line, as if that would confirm who this person is to us, although
you don't
no
know
idea
what the voices sound
what
like
the voice right, sounds right, right. like, right? And then he walks off into another room and starts screaming. And there's a shouting match going on, and Mike and I are talking to his assistant and trying to figure out, like, who is this person? And then later it emerges that it's an aide to Xi Jinping.
That's what he says.
That's what he says.
That's what he says.
That's okay. What emerges from Yvette.
We got a name. We can't say it.
Okay.
So this emerges from Yvette, his assistant. And so we're going, well, wait, but on the first he told us it was this other person. And now you're telling us it's a special assistant. And the whole thing, it sort of felt like it was, the purpose of it was to give this sense that, you know, he actually is talking directly to, you know, the senior leadership.
It was theater for the New York Times.
It seemed that way.
It sounds so staged.
We could be very cynical, though, right? You know?
I mean, it's the whole, anyway, so, but again, this is this whole, like, you're sitting there and you're like, is this real? Isn't this real? What is going on here? You know, like, how do we understand this?
So he has another thing, is it real or isn't it real? When he was in D.C., I think he tweeted from the Trump International Tower in Washington, claiming to have met with a couple of guys from the Public Security Bureau, a dissident minder from Gobao and another guy, and that apparently these guys, or he says, these guys were then picked up by the FBI and sent back to China.
Did you try to run that one down?
We're trying, actually.
Okay.
So there was this guy he was going to meet. He said, you know, Sun Li Jun, who is, I think he's in the PSB, and he's head of the Guobao. So he's the guy in charge of looking after people like Guo. But we don't have any independent confirmation that they met. We don't have any independent confirmation that Sun Li Jun was in the United States. But, you know, he certainly was tweeting pictures from Trump International, you know, or in
circumstantial, you know. Yeah. What about justice? Did they say anything about having removed two Chinese nationals?
Yeah, you know,
we're still reporting that.
It's messy right now, and we're just trying to get our facts straight on that. But I wouldn't put that in the same category as things totally unbelievable. And certainly, the reason you know about this is because you were reading about it maybe in Mingjing and some other publications that have written about it.
He wants you to believe that he has a back channel, though, to Xi Jinping, either through this PSV connection, through this phone call that he supposedly took. He's conspicuously omitted direct attacks against Xi.
That's right.
What's going on there? Do you have a theory? Do you have a working theory, Alex?
No, but Victor sure actually has an interesting theory.
Yeah, I mean, well, he was... I mean...
Victor's my friend.
Victor's a good guy. I mean, he certainly indicates...
It's an intriguing theory.
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Oh, well, I mean...
Ampli caveated.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember how much we put, you know, in the story and what we left out and everything. But, I mean, there does seem... You know, I've talked to other people since the publication of our story even that suggest that, you know, that there may be some tension between the two of them, that Wang has acquired an incredible amount of power. And even people who know Wang Qishan very well will say the Wang Qishan of 2017 is not the Wang Qishan of 10 years ago or 15 years ago, that he has changed. I don't know what that means exactly, but there are enough people saying that there may be some tension, but is it
tension? So it could be 借刀杀人, kind of that kind
of. But is it tension enough for Xi Jinping to be basically employing Maoist tactics to undermine Wang Qishan? I don't know. But certainly he does want us and other people to believe that. He did say, in fact, he said it with his Voice of America interview in April.
Which I want to talk about in just a second.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, he said in that interview that she, through Fu Zhenghua, had asked him to look into Wang Qishan's family. You know, we could go on for hours and hours, but, you know, I do find, and I can't get into great details, that, for a guy who has supposedly looked at HNA's shareholding structure, I think there are some interesting gaps in his knowledge that anybody who would have looked at the HNA for one or two days would have been very familiar with. And I've been kind of surprised at the lack of familiarity sometimes. So he knows some things really well and he knows other things not so well. It's, you know, some things he says are true, some things he says are patently untrue. It's just such a mix.
So if you had this guy on the shrink's couch and he had to offer a sort of pop diagnosis, what is his pathology? What is going on with this guy? I mean, is it just your straight up, you know, megalomania? Is he just a world class narcissist? Is he nurturing these sort of Count of Monte Cristo revenge fantasies? What's going on with this guy? I mean, psychologically.
I think there's an element of narcissism, but I just get the distinct feeling that there's something else at play that we're missing. There's a piece that we're not seeing.
God, yeah.
I can't answer that question straight up because I can't get a hold on a read on him properly.
Mike, yeah. And we've spent, you know, I keep track of this. I think, you know, we're on about 15 or 16 hours of just one-on-one, you know, the two of us and him and his also stronger than a garlic milkshake assistant. You don't want to meet her in a dark alley. Mm-hmm. There is something else. I mean, clearly he does have a whole bunch of money in China that's frozen, assets that are frozen now. He's got relatives there and employees there. Is this a very high stakes bargaining? I mean, we've never seen a tweeting narcissistic Chinese billionaire before. So it's kind of new territory.
Well, and as much as a lot of horrible things being discussed, isn't it great for you guys? I mean, isn't this a really fascinating, I mean, how often do you get to, even if you're not sure if it's real or not, but you get a look at some.
I'm jealous.
Things
it's
you can't usually see in China.
What a ride. I mean, wow.
But just to go back, I mean, just real quick, the idea that there's greater things going on in the background, you know, where's he getting these documents and why specific documents? And, you know, because he ostensibly doesn't have any access anymore to the mainland, unless you believe that he is talking directly to people like Xi Jinping. When he shows us certain documents and he's shown us, for example, the other day, a package that was supposedly one corporate official's entire rundown of bank accounts at every single different bank, how many accounts, how much is in the accounts, no account numbers. You're kind of like, I mean, where do you get this information from? And why are you giving it to us? Like, why this person? So, you know, the whole thing is just a big mystery.
Oh, God.
Let's talk about the VOA interview then.
Yes.
So this was a little scandal in some ways. He was going to have a 3-hour, I believe it was scheduled to be a 3-hour interview with VOA, and it was stopped.
About 73 minutes or something.
Yeah, right. And one of the editors who was working on it basically said there was pressure from the Chinese foreign ministry. And another person at VOA denied it and said that there was some other issue with the, you know, procedures not being followed and giving space to a apparently malevolent, defamer to speak his mind. But do you have any sense of what really went?
I think it probably bears mentioning too that Mike, you worked for Amanda Bennett, who is now the head of the VOA.
Yep.
And she basically went to bat for you. I mean, not just she resigned her position basically in solidarity with you over that whole business after Winkler made his that telephone call that you talked about to the Times.
I mean, yeah, I
after Bloomberg self-censored, let's put it that way.
If I'm biased in this whole incident, it's that I think the world of Amanda Bennett. You know, she has proven she was the editor of the Xi Jinping story at Bloomberg. She was the one who faced down the ambassador, who is Zhang Yesui at the time in Washington, and told him, "We're publishing the story."
So why on earth would she have
exactly? So I was watching a VOA interview, and then it got cut off. And as a reporter, you know, we're not supposed to leap to conclusions, but of course I had visions of Kushner dancing in my head. And I had pictured Cui Tianyi, the ambassador, giving Kushner a call saying, "Get that guy off the air." And Kushner calling Amanda Bennett or somebody and saying, "Get that guy off the air." The truth is much more boring. That didn't happen, it looks like, at all. In fact, it doesn't look like there wasn't any pressure that I know of from the White House. And in fact, they're not allowed to do that. Not, you know, of course, they're not allowed to do a lot of things. But,
they're not allowed to, to tell the FBI director.
The truth is a little more prosaic, but also quite, I think, a little disturbing. So I wrote about it that day. I talked to both sides. You know, I know the VOA China side people. I've done interviews with them in Chinese before, and they follow what I do. And, you know, and so I was able to talk to them and talk to the management at VOA as well. And indeed, there was pressure on VOA. They did what they did to Bloomberg. They called in their, you know, reporter in Beijing to the foreign ministry, said, "Don't do this. Don't air this interview," because it had been publicized for days before this 3 hours of Guo and Gui on Voice of America. It looks like a few days before this thing went to air that the VOA management had said, you know, it's really not a good idea to have this guy on for 3 hours. He throws out allegation after allegation. Having a guy on Voice of America, a rather straight news organization, throwing out allegations against the Chinese government is, you know, maybe it's not what we want to do. Yeah. Maybe not what we want to do. I think they negotiated to have him on for an hour and then go to tape and, you know, record him, tape him, and whatever allegations he makes afterwards, go and fact check him, go and report him out. And the first hour went, and indeed he started making allegations. The second hour began, and he upped the volume to 11 with his allegations about Wang Qishan and Xi Jinping asking, you know, Fu Zhenghua through Guo Wengui through Fu Zhenghua to investigate Wang Qishan. And then it got cut off right then. And from what I understand, the reason it got cut off is because
the agreement was
it was supposed to go an hour. And I think we've been hearing some pretty harsh things from the Chinese service, from the reporter there. And she, in fact, put in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. I think, you know, this gets back a little bit to the whole Pied Piper element of Guo Wengui. I think he says things that people want to hear. People do tend to get excited about the fact that there's this guy with real means, with real money, apparently, who's now on their side, I guess, or talking about rule of law, democracy in China, and trying to stick it to the Communist Party. And they get caught up in that. And so I think it makes a lot of sense to me, and this is my opinion, but, you know, I've been there before. I've worked with Amanda Bennett. Understanding what VOA was asking seemed to me completely reasonable from a journalistic point of view. In fact, it was extremely generous to keep Guo Wengui on the air
for a whole hour.
And they did. And so, you know, yes, before they did get calls from the Chinese embassy. They got the foreign ministry in Beijing on this. There was pressure, but it doesn't look like they buckled to the pressure. It looks like they had made this agreement. And it's really ugly, you know, what's going on.
But some of the
now.
Reporters were just not on board with that, and they freaked out.
Oh, and some have been suspended, right?
Yeah, they weren't on board. And, you know, it's my understanding there is an investigation going on, but it's gets caught up in politics now, too. And, you know, now, you know, the fact that the Wall Street Journal's been like a home for some of these attacks on VOA now, it's ugly and, you know, and sad.
Sad, although very sad, because probably none of them will have jobs if President Trump has his way. So,
Mike, I need to be mindful of your time. I know that you need to roll out of here real soon. Very quick last question before we do recommendations very quickly. How does this end? What are some possible scenarios for how this plays out? Alex, you want to take a shot? I mean, he's not going to be extradited. That's pretty clear, right? There's no circumstances.
He indicates, and he seemed, and we know that in the past he's been in contact with U.S. government officials, and he indicates that he still has ties here. And the most recent story about May 26, mm-hmm. you know, his D.C. adventure. You know, he indicates that he was again helped by the government. So I think he's going to be okay. I think he has enough of an in some way with the U.S. government, but you never know.
We sort of don't know until November, right? I mean, is this that? Mike, what about you? What do you think?
How does this play out? He's gotten enough publicity now in the United States, two front page stories in the New York Times, for one, you know, that he's well known. You know, would that stop the Trump administration from trading him away? You know, and you could make a case that maybe that would make sense to trade him away for something, you know, but what's the U.S. going to get for him? And so I think this goes on for a while. And I don't know where it ends exactly. He's going to be a thorn in the side, you know, for a little while here, it looks like, is my guess.
This really puts into stark relief our limitations, the limitations of our knowledge about what happens in behind the scenes in Beijing, doesn't it, Jeremy?
It does indeed. I mean, if you compare the TikToks you get about, like, you know, American politics, where you pretty much know the color of the shoes on at a secret meeting, we know nothing.
Well, we are really anxious to hear more. I hope that you'll come back and join us for further conversations about this story, because it's going to be really the story of the year in Chinese politics. And thank you so much for taking the time and being so candid with us about your reporting and sharing this with our audience. We need to be respectful of Mike's time here. So let me quickly pay some bills, and then we can get to recommendations. Before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at subchina.com. You can follow SubChina on Twitter at SubChinaNews and on Facebook at facebook.com/SubChinaNews. And if you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, go and leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store, on Google Play, or wherever it is that you go to review apps. This helps us a lot. It means a whole ton to Jeremy and me. On to recommendations. Jeremy, why don't you start us off, and let's try to be kind of quick here.
All right. The Skeptics Society, I think it's called. They have a website, and they publish articles that debunk pseudoscience, debunk the latest diet fad, debunk the latest religion. They haven't got to Guo and Gui claims, but it's the kind of
thing they would do.
Anyways, they have a podcast and email newsletter. Very good if you, like Kaiser and me, tend to be skeptical.
Alex, what do you have for us?
It's completely off topic, Janesville, An American Story, uh-huh. which is written by Amy Goldstein of the The Washington Post. And it's about Janesville after GM suddenly picked up and left in 2008, months after Obama had gone to Janesville and said, there will be jobs at the GM factory for 100 years to come. So it's a fascinating kind of look at how the whole town, city.
Which way did that county vote in 2016?
Isn't that Paul Ryan's district? Is it in Paul Ryan's?
It is. But actually, interestingly, Rock County, which is Janesville, Beloit, and a couple of other uh-huh. places, voted 51 or 52% Democrat.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, one of the few counties. So
now there's this new guy who's going to be challenging.
Iron Stash.
Oh, that's a very timely book. It's a very excellent recommendation. Love to hear more about it, but Mike, move on.
So my recommendation is not going to be out for a little while, but it's a book called Betraying Big Brother, and it is about the rise of the feminist movement in China.
Do you know
the author?
I just happen to be married to the author.
Just by coincidence.
Leita Hong Fincher. And I tell you, though, it is an amazing book, and it gets into how important it is to the Chinese state to control women and to put them in their place. And it just gets into, in great detail, just the incredible apparatus that's been set up to.
Yeah, that was, you know, one of the sort of the claims that Leta made in her last book, that this whole sort of leftover women construct was sort of a state-sponsored thing. It's one that did get a little bit of pushback from some of the critics of the book. So it did.
This is very different, though. This is a narrative book about what happened to the Feminist Five, and it gets into such detail about what happened when they were in jail and what happened after jail and the horrible threats that were put on them and their families, that anybody reading it will come away.
Well, tell her to send us galleys and we'll put her on the show and talk about it.
I will.
Looking forward to it. That's going to be a good one. Yeah, I've been recommending a bunch of not yet published books, so I'm going to go for a couple years old that I just happened to find on Netflix the other night, flipping around. The director, Cary Joji Fukunaga, who many of you might know, it's a Netflix movie called Beast of No Nation. It takes place in an unnamed West African country, and follows the life of a child soldier who is in a buffer zone town that then gets taken over by some sort of crazed megalomaniacal commandant and his army of boy soldiers.
I've seen that. That is great.
It is very good. I mean, because if you know anything about, so he did his own cinematography for us, and the guy is just fantastic with a camera.
Yeah, the boy actor is just
He's just amazing. Agu, the guy. Plays, check it out. It's a very good film. A Beast of No Nation. Alex, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us. Mike.
Before we end, I have a favor to ask the two of you. Next time you see Gore, can you ask him why he blocked me on Twitter?
Yes.
Okay.
Why did you block
him? Did you tweet at him?
I don't think so. I don't know what I did.
He unfollowed my wife, too. He unfollowed later. What's going on?
Yeah, you got to ask about that.
Well, Shkreli, you know.
Yeah.
The
horrible, evil $900 pill man.
Exactly. Yeah. He one day just blocked me, and I have no idea why. I mean, I wrote about him, but not in a sort of, you know, like I think he just decided to block everybody.
Your feelings must have been terribly hurt.
Oh, terribly hurt.
Well, I promise I won't block you guys if you follow me on Twitter. The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Gwil and Jeremy Goldcorn. Thanks also to Anila Chang and Saraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/cynicalpodcast and follow us on Twitter. Again, we will not block you. At Cynical Pod. We might block you for a real thing. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care. Thanks, guys.